And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, though one of the most unpopular aspects of life in this great nation is paying taxes. And yeah, we pay more taxes than ever before today. If you count federal, state, and local, the percentage of the gross domestic product, we are talking about a very, very heavy burden that most Americans pay. They work for nearly half the year before you've paid off everything you're going to pay to government at various levels. How did it get that way? Well, the government grew. It took more and more. It was able to take more and more. But there are mysteries about this. Was the Constitution properly amended by the 16th Amendment to the Constitution? Who was responsible for that constitutional amendment, which allowed what Amity Schles calls, and actually Thomas Paine calls, the greedy hand to take more and more with aspects of taxes like the income tax? And is there a better way to try to collect the money that we need for government than this current nightmarish tax system? All of that we're going to confront in this very special, very timely broadcast, The Truth About Taxes.
'Cause I'm the tax man.
And everybody hates taxes. I mean, I hate the entire process. It's one of my least favorite times of the year. It's one of my least favorite aspects of living in the United States. There has to be a better way. There was a better way. I think a lot of Americans would look back fondly on those days when we could support the entire federal establishment and big armies, as a matter of fact, and do it almost entirely with tariffs and some excise taxes, taxes on liquor and some other items that would be imposed legally by the federal government. One of the things that is a natural reaction to as invasive and oppressive as taxes are today is a tax resistance movement. But I've got to tell you that what passes as a tax resistance movement today, those people led by, well, one particular guru who is currently in jail serving a 13-year sentence, that tax resistance movement is feeble, it is irrational, and it should be avoided and shunned at all costs. But we'll explain to you why. One of the things that was very, very clear out of the Pollack case, which ruled out an attempt by the federal government to impose an income tax back in 1894, the Pollack case said no. It didn't say that all income tax would be definitionally unconstitutional. What it said is the Constitution required that if you were going to tax income that came from property, then you would have to provide that that tax was distributed evenly according to population, which would have created a huge mess of different tax rates in different states according to population. Because, for instance, a very rich state would then have a much lower tax rate because the people were earning more money per capita, per person who lived in that state. In any event, it created this necessity for amending the Constitution of the United States, or at least it was a necessity in terms of the people. And that was a lot of people in all parties who believed that you absolutely needed to have the ability to amend the Constitution and to impose an income tax. The final resolution of this dispute came about 15 years after the Pollack case, after a lot of controversy and back and forth and political back and forth. For the most part, the idea of a low tariff and a big income tax, a steep income tax, that was supported strongly by people on the left. The Populist Party, the Democratic Party under William Jennings Bryan, they called for a graduated income tax that would hit rich people very hard and hit working people a little bit less hard. The Populist Party demanded a graduated income tax as part of 1892 platform, even before the Pollock case. But this agitation for a constitutional amendment really took form and became serious when the progressive Republicans were in charge of the government. President Roosevelt was an advocate for changing the Constitution to allow an income tax. But it wasn't President Roosevelt. It was his successor, President William Howard Taft, who shortly after he took over the White House, after TR, after Teddy Roosevelt, Taft, on June 16th, 1909, spoke to Congress and proposed a 2% federal income tax on corporations. But he understood that needed to be a constitutional amendment to allow the previously enacted income tax. In other words, what he said was this: upon the privilege of doing business as an artificial entity and of freedom from a general partnership liability by those who own the stock. That was the income tax amendment was formally proposed by a Republican senator from Nebraska, Norris Brown, and that came a few months later. And what's amazing about this is how quickly after it passed in Congress with bipartisan support, this amendment to the Constitution, the 16th Amendment of the Constitution, the wording of the 16th Amendment was very simple and very direct. It said this, that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. In other words, it got them out of the bind that had been imposed by that very mysterious and difficult to understand clause in the original Constitution. And what's amazing is you look at the list of states that quickly ratified this 16th Amendment. It's pretty striking because Alabama was the first state to ratify. Then Kentucky, South Carolina, Illinois, Mississippi. Ultimately, the 16th Amendment was very popular. It was fully ratified in relatively short order, and it became part of our Constitution on February 3rd, 1913. Now, why am I emphasizing this date? Because one of the things that so many people get wrong is they associate this amendment to the Constitution with Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson wasn't president when the amendment was ratified on February 3rd, 1913. William Howard Taft, the Republican, was. Wilson was about to become president a couple of weeks later, but he was president-elect already. But really, it is tough to blame him for this particular amendment. The implementation of the amendment came a little bit later. And by the way, the history of the ratification helps to explain why we have Tax Day on April 15th. I've always wondered about that. And part of the truth about taxes is that April 15th was chosen as Tax Day. Actually, originally, Tax Day was going to be March 15th. Well, they were going back and forth between April and March. And in 1918, right after the Internal Revenue Service had cranked up the income tax, in March of Revenue Act of 1918 moved the date forward to March 15th. But then back in 1955, they pushed the date later to April 15th. You know why? So they could hold your money longer, because so many people were applying for refunds. And it actually helped the government to hold your money longer. Now, all of this is the law of the land. And for better or worse, we began funding the federal government based upon the income tax. The income tax started out at a very, very low rate, and then it went up and up and up. But all of this, of course, has produced a tax resistance movement. And the tax resistance movement is led by a guy named Erwin Schiff, who going all the way back to the 1970s, has been pushing this theory that the federal income tax is unconstitutional. But what's wrong with a tax resistance theory? We will get to that and to the history of battles over how much they take out of your paycheck. That and more on this special broadcast. On the Michael Medved Show, a special broadcast, the shocking truth about taxes. And when you talk about days in which Americans paid 92% top marginal rate, and even 94% top marginal rate, there were 2 years in the middle of World War II, 1944 and 1945, where we imposed a top marginal rate in taxes of 94%. Can you imagine? That's almost like the Beatles song Taxman, 19 for just five, one for you and 19 for me. It's the virtual equivalent of a brief, short-lived British top tax of 95%. How did Americans endure this? Well, the answer is pretty much nobody actually paid taxes at that rate. Why not? Because the top rate only kicked in, and this is just stunning. You actually have to go back and dig to find this out. But the top income tax rate that kicked in for 94%, that only kicked in for people earning incomes above $5 million at the time. That would be the equivalent of about $85 million today. So you didn't have many people with that kind of income, and it didn't really collect that much money. That's one of the things that people have to understand about this idea of top marginal rates. People go back and they say, oh, yeah, back in the Eisenhower era, we were paying 91% and 92%. We were paying all this money and we did fine. We were very prosperous. Well, nobody actually paid the money. How do we know? Because when you look at taxes and you look at tax rates and income tax rates, you have to look at the percentage of money that actually was taken out of the private economy and went to the federal government in all terms. And there are federal figures available. For instance, during World War I, we imposed a top rate of 77%. Ouch! And that was shortly, of course, after the income tax had been established. And all of a sudden you're taking 77%. Yeah, but you're not taking it from many people. Why not? Because the top rate at the time only kicked in for people who were earning an equivalent in today's money of $16 million a year. It only kicked in money you earned above that. And that just wasn't that many people in 1917 and 1918. And that's why, even with those high taxes, what was a percentage that was taken out of the private economy and sent to the federal government? Never went above 9%. It was always below 9% until the taxes increased very, very sharply later under Franklin Roosevelt and the expansion of government. One of the things that is very important to understand, however, is of course everybody wishes in some kind of perfect world that we didn't have federal income tax. But the fact is that we do, and the people who pretend that we don't are dangerous. How do we know they're dangerous? There's this guy named Erwin Schiff, and he's now 85 years old. He should live and be well. He just celebrated his 85th birthday in prison in the Federal Correctional Institution in Fort Worth, Texas. His projected release date is 2017, if he lives that long. He's a longtime activist with the Libertarian Party. He was actually a candidate for the Libertarian Party presidential nomination in 1996 during part of his brief sojourns out of jail. But why does he go to jail? Because he keeps bringing to court these tax resistance schemes that are based upon, oh, various arguments. One argument that Ohio was not legally a state when it ratified the 16th Amendment. Now, never mind that ultimately 42 out of the then 48 states ratified the 16th Amendment. There are only six states that didn't. The only big states that didn't were Florida and Pennsylvania, and they never even considered the 16th Amendment. Everybody else ratified. It was ratified. It's the law of the land. And then claiming that the amendment as it passed by Congress was differently worded than the amendment that was ratified by some of the states. All of these various technicalities and all of these interesting arguments, and they've all landed him in jail because courts have thrown them out consistently because they're held to be frivolous. Now, who's right on an argument like this? Well, we have a legal system. We have a court system. And the courts have repeatedly found that the Constitution was changed in 1913 in February. They imposed a 16th Amendment. And that 16th Amendment allows them to impose an income tax, and you got to pay it. Otherwise, you end up in jail. Remember the actor Wesley Snipes, the star of White Men Can't Jump, Blade, bunch of other movies? One time, one of the highest paid Hollywood stars, he reported to federal prison on December 9th, 2010, to begin his 3-year sentence. He should be out soon. The courts have refused to hear his appeal. He made the problem of following the Irwin Schiff line and trying to use that to explain why he didn't pay taxes. If there is one important message above any other to get out from this particular show, it's that the income tax system stinks. It's lousy. It's irrational. It's intrusive. It's burdensome. It needs to be improved. But it's law of the land, and you defy it at your extreme cost. I don't want to see any of our listeners, I don't want to see anybody out there ending up like Irwin Schiff or Wesley Snipes. Meanwhile, the arguments about raising and lowering tax rates. One of the problems with our tax system in this country, and every economist will point this out, is that Congress won't leave it alone. They raise and they lower tax rates. Andrew Mellon, who took over after Wilson's misrule, and Wilson greatly increased taxes, though he didn't that greatly. He actually, if you talk about what Wilson collected as a percentage of the total economy for the federal government, what government at all levels collected under Wilson, was a fraction of what it is today. A federal, state, and local taxes. Total, the last year of the Wilson administration, 1918, still came to below 10% for every branch of government. Today, we're talking about well over 30% and headed north for all the different forms of government direct revenue. That's a huge difference. How did that happen? And what can you do to stop it? Is there a better way for government to collect taxes that it needs to operate? There clearly is. What is it? We'll get to that and much more on this special broadcast, The Shocking Truth About Taxes.
Thanks for listening and subscribe today for our new Substack newsletter. That's Michael Medved's Context, placing today's big events in the unique perspective of our past and our future. Go to michaelmedved.substack.com and sign up today for my uncensored take on current controversies.
How did it happen in the land of the free and the home of the brave that we got entangled in this massive and nightmarish tax system? The tax code is of unbelievable complexity. I think that the best estimate is that if you actually try to read it, it's 8 times longer than the Bible. And that's Old and New Testaments. It's a lot of words, and they don't add up, and they confuse people. And the result of all of that is today, in the United States, at this moment, the average American, or even below average American, somebody starting out at McDonald's at a minimum wage, has more money taken out of his paycheck without his consent, and often without his knowledge, than a millionaire, multimillionaire, would pay on his extra millions at the beginning of the tax system. The beginning of the tax system, the top tax rate that they imposed on anyone in the income tax was 7%. Now they do more than that, just your share of the payroll tax. It's called Social Security, and that's part of what happened and that allowed all this to come about. In her history of the mess that we're in, Amity Schles begins her story in The Greedy Hand with a story of a gentleman named Beardsley Rummel. Great name, isn't it? Sounds like a character. He was an executive at Macy's, the department store company. And he had this brainstorm that he suggested to the Federal Reserve System. And this is shortly after Pearl Harbor, when America had to raise a bunch of money in a big hurry to win a giant war. And the brainstorm was withholding tax, that all of a sudden you would get the employers to become tax collectors. They would withhold money out of people's paychecks every week and then send it on to the government. Easy, relatively painless, and people would accept it. How did we know that they would accept it? They had already started Social Security. And Social Security was removing money from... Now, of course, Social Security was based upon a fraud. The fraud was, well, the money is going somewhere. It's going to be put in your account. It'll be all in your account. The account is just an IOU. The money's spent. The money's spent. It's gone. There is no money. There's no lockbox. There is no Social Security trust fund. There are a bunch of promises. And by the way, people at the time pointed it out. There was in the late 30s, before the war, there was a big expose in the Boston Herald American that talked about the fraud of Social Security and the deceit of this thing. But of course, people bought into it and they thought it was their patriotic duty. And then when Roosevelt came in and we were fighting depression and then we were fighting war, people accepted, well, almost anything during World War II. But this came along with such mind-numbing complexity because the desire of the left was to use the tax system not just to raise money for government, but to tell people how to live their lives, to give certain breaks for certain behaviors and higher rates for other behaviors. And the result of this is in 1947, when the tax code was just a fraction of what it is today, Judge Learned Hand, one of the most respected legal scholars, wrote in the Yale Law Journal, "In my own case, the words of such an act as the income tax merely dance before my eyes in a meaningless procession, cross-reference to cross-reference, exception upon exception, couched in abstract terms that offer me no handle to seize hold of and that leave in my mind only a confused sense of some vitally important but successfully concealed purport, which it is my duty to extract, but which is within my power, if at all, only after the most inordinate expenditure of time. I know that these monsters are the result of fabulous industry and ingenuity, plugging up this hole and casting out that net against all possible evasion. Yet at times I cannot help recalling a saying of William James about certain passages of Hegel, that they were no doubt written with a passion of rationality, but that one cannot help wondering whether to the reader they have any significance save that the words are strung together with syntactical correctness." Okay, if one of the most brilliant legal scholars in American history, Learned Hand, says, "I can read the Internal Revenue Code and can't understand it." Anybody here ever tried to read it? It's a nightmare. And Learned Hand is exactly right. It doesn't mean anything. You can't figure it out. Which is why the typical American today spends about 30 hours a year just trying to fill out his taxes. That's an average middle-class guy. Is there a better way? We will get to that and the tax revolt of the 1970s and 80s coming up.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
In an odd bit of casting, the acclaimed British thespian Rebecca Hall stars in the latest release to pair two of Hollywood's biggest stars ever. Following up on Godzilla vs. Kong from 2021, now we get Godzilla Kong, The New Empire.
Kong, Godzilla, they can feel it. Something is coming. Something even they're afraid of.
That's a call for war.
Yeah, but will the two big guys work out their differences and learn to team up in order to save our world and that other world that exists in the Hollow Earth? The plot is not only ridiculous, which you'd expect, but it's just about impossible to follow. But the special effects are spectacular, and you actually feel more emotionally connected to Kong than any of his previous films. This is rated PG-13 because there's a lot of stuff and monsters that get smashed. 2 stars for these two big stars because Godzilla Kong: The New Empire delivers the goods for diehard fans of this franchise.
And on the Michael Medved Show, a very special broadcast, The Shocking Truth About Taxes. And I'll tell you, part of the shocking truth involves the notion long ago that people actually were proud to pay taxes, and they liked it, and they liked the process. An old guy like Joe Biden can even remember that. That's why he talks about paying a lot of taxes as a patriotic duty. There was a 1953 episode of The Honeymooners. You know The Honeymooners with Jackie Gleason. He plays Ralph Cramden. He plays a bus driver who's really struggling to get ahead, lives in a very plain sort of down-on-the-heels apartment. And in the episode in particular, he gets furious because he gets a letter and he finds out that the government reviewed his taxes and they find out that he owes $15 in extra taxes. And he's angry because he had been saving that money to buy a bowling ball. And he goes back and forth and back and forth. At the end of the episode, he comes to his senses and he decides he's glad to pay the extra tax. He says, "We're living in a great country, Alice," he tells his wife. "I didn't mean that before, what I said about the income tax. Boy, we should give everything to the government, especially this government." 1953. Would anyone say that today? You see, this is part of what happened, is the so-called greatest generation lived through the Depression. They lived through World War II. That episode was right at the very tail end of the Korean War. People were sacrificing their lives. We were fighting communism. We were trying to beat back Stalin just as we had beaten back Hitler. The government was trying to accomplish great purposes. Does anyone really feel that about our tax system today? The problem is that you're not even asked to, because of withholding and because of the payroll tax and then the hidden payroll tax. See, most people, if they're paying combined their Medicare and Social Security, they're paying close to 8%. More if you're with some of the extra taxes under the Obama era, you don't realize that your employer is also paying money in on your behalf, supposedly. It's not really in your behalf. It's just an extra tax on your employer. And that's money that he could be using to provide benefits or raise to you. So really, the burden is enormous on every single American.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show, The Shocking Truth About Taxes.
Thanks for listening and subscribe today for our new Substack newsletter. That's Michael Medved's Context, placing today's big events in the unique perspective of our past and our future. Go to michaelmedved.substack.com and sign up today for my uncensored take on current controversies.
You're listening to a special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show, The Shocking Truth About Taxes. For more history programs, go to MedvedHistoryStore.com.
And this is why Republicans are in so much trouble whenever people say, oh, 47% of Americans don't pay taxes. Yes, they do. They pay that payroll tax. And it hurts. And it takes away a lot of money. And Milton Friedman was one of those people who, back in the middle of World War II, supported the idea of withholding, supported the idea that the government could subtract money automatically without even informing you about it. And then after the war, he wrote his memoirs, and he realized this was a big mistake, that he had once supported it. He says, "We concentrated single-mindedly on promoting the war effort. We gave next to no consideration to any longer-run consequences. It never occurred to me at the time that I was helping to develop the machinery that would make possible a government that I would come to criticize severely as too large, too intrusive, too destructive of freedom. Yet that was precisely what I was doing." There is an important lesson here, writes the Nobel Prize-winning economist. He writes, "It is far easier to introduce a government program than to get rid of it." One of many tax reforms that's been suggested is one that we went back to the old system, where instead of the money being automatically taken out of your account, you received a bill, you had to face it. Could be a quarterly bill, could be a yearly bill. Very unlikely to happen. But it was also deemed unlikely to happen that we would have the tax revolt that we had in the 1970s. And ground zero for that tax revolt was California, which elected Ronald Reagan as governor in 1966. And where, because of various court decisions and legislative policies, property tax became a huge issue. Now, the problem with property tax was that people would be paying more and more and more and more without getting any more money. In other words, if your house is going up in value rapidly, as happened in California, you have to pay more and more and more to the state in property taxes based on the valuation of your house. But unless you take out another mortgage, or unless you decide to sell your house and move somewhere else, you don't have any more money. This, by the way, happened to my late in-laws. They literally had to sell their home because they could no longer afford to pay the increasing property tax. This resulted in Proposition 13 in California, and it was an epical moment in the history of the whole fight of taxation in the United States. Voters were called out to an election, primary election, in 1978. They had a huge turnout. They had a 70% turnout, and people voted 2-1 to limit the amount of property tax they could take out of your home. And also to limit the amount of make-believe home values that they could charge you on. Now, this is on state taxes. Meanwhile, in terms of tax reform today, that property tax revolt helped feed the Reagan Revolution, which was based upon an idea of lowering top tax rates, lowering taxes across the board. Ultimately, the most important of the Reagan tax reforms occurred in 1986. Which was radical tax simplification, getting rid of loopholes, getting rid of the top rate, getting rid of a whole top rate, and bringing the top rate that anyone would pay on anything they earned to 28%. Doesn't that sound sweet today when we're back up for top earners to 39.6%? If we could fund winning the Cold War in the Reagan era, so how do we get there again? One of the proposals was actually made for getting there again by President Reagan's partner in that 1986 reform that dropped the top rate all the way down to 28%. By the way, without dropping the money to government. Government actually took in more money because the economy boomed. So Bill Bradley, the former senator from New Jersey, Democrat, has an idea of how to do it again. Worth considering? That and other reform ideas in this special broadcast coming up.
This is Michael Medved at michaelmedved.com for Town Hall. With names changing on public buildings and statues coming down almost everywhere, the cancel culture now also wants to remake our money. A full page in the New York Times proposed new faces for our coins and bills, emphasizing diversity and artistic achievement, not political leadership. They wanted Marsha P. Johnson, a self-described black drag queen and activist, for the $10 bill, with Wilma Mankiller, first female chief of the Cherokee Nation, for the $5 bill. More than 50 other historical figures also received consideration, with white males mentioned only if they were gay or leftist radicals. This meant no Mark Twain, no Frank Lloyd Wright, no Frank Capra, no George Gershwin, and so forth. In fact, reviewing the Times list reveals an inconvenient truth. In the arts, as in government, the American tradition has been shaped most importantly, though hardly exclusively, by males of European ancestry. Pretending otherwise counts as both ignorant and dishonest. I'm Michael Medved.
Of all the achievements of President Ronald Reagan, none was greater than the tax reform plan of 1986. It involved a radical simplification of the tax system. Some purists would say not enough, but my goodness, what an improvement. And money flowed into the government, and it worked. It was betrayed in the breaking of the No New Taxes pledge by President Reagan's successor, George Herbert Walker Bush. And yes, we were suffering from a painful deficit at the time. But the increase in tax rates, the abandonment of the Reagan simplification, was a disaster. Bill Bradley, who is the author of the original Reagan simplification, together with President Reagan and Dan Rostenkowski and a bunch of other people, says we should go back and replay that idea, which was basically saying, okay, we're going to get rid of a bunch of loopholes, and at the same time, we're going to lower tax rates for everybody dramatically. The top tax rate was lowered in that reform from 50% down to 28%. Wow. Okay. What Bradley says is in order to make more revenue, we get rid of the loopholes first with a promise that the rates get lowered later. Now, of course, Republicans won't fall for that, and nor should they. And most conservatives look at radical tax reform in one of two forms, either a flat tax or a fair tax. A flat tax would be a system whereby you didn't have exemptions or deductions at all. You just paid a straight amount off the top. And that would cover Social Security. It would cover everything. You would have it visible. And the simplification, the saving of time would be enormous. It works, by the way, in about 15 nations on planet Earth, including Russia, where they have a top flat tax. They have a flat tax of 13%. The fair tax would replace the whole system of reporting income and filing income taxes by basically a national sales tax with some kind of tax payment that would come back to make sure that poor people weren't paying that and that they got back more than the extra money that they were paying for stuff they buyed at stores. The problem with both of these kinds of tax reform is it's hard to imagine a situation where you get the consensus to do that kind of sweeping reform. Probably the best we can hope for is a kind of radical simplification that gets rid of loopholes and lowers tax rates. That's what Simpson-Bowles called for. The great thing about that kind of simplification is the tax system gives us a vision of an ugly, incompetent, overcomplicated, intrusive, stupid government. Wouldn't it be great if we could get back to Ralph Cramden's idea from The Honeymooners, that it was a great government, that you were proud to pay taxes? If it could be simpler, clearer, less burdensome and intrusive, wouldn't that be a way to have a government great enough to be worthy of the greatest nation on God's green earth?